on 1430 KAS. I told you I'm excited. I'm beyond excited today. I was going through my email a few days ago, and I ran across what I thought looked like an interesting subject. And it was by a young man called Bruce Thatcher, a former alumnus of KASI, and also Channel 5. We found that out, too. Bruce, good morning. How are you? Whoop, let me punch that other button, Bruce. There we go. Good morning. How are you?
Hello?
Yeah. How are you, Bruce?
I'm just fine.
Good. You know what? 25 years in the business, I'm still punching buttons wrong. We were just chatting a little bit. I was telling the listeners out there that you are indeed an Iowa State alumnus to begin with. And
I am.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I graduated in winter quarter of 59.
And then also an alumnus of WOI TV.
When I came, I got out of high school at Sioux City Central midterm in January, and because I had some commercial engineering licenses, I knew I was going to be going to Iowa State. I went down there early and managed to get a job with WOI TV and worked for a couple of quarters there before the regular fall school started.
Now, do you see the keywords he used there, folks? And I'm very familiar with them. Quarters. Because everything's semesters now. Me too. In fact, I was still taking classes when we converted from quarters to semesters. That was a little bit of a pain, but
okay.
Yeah, but we got there and also worked right here at 1430 KASI when it was over in the Old Town Center.
Well, I did. I got married at the end of my junior year and suddenly discovered I needed to make some money. So using my licenses, I walked into KSI, decided that would be a good place for me to work, and walked into Bill Evans' office. He was the owner at that time, and asked him if he had room for an engineer. And he didn't answer me right away, but he said, "Here, sit down." And he handed me a book with some commercials in it. And he said, "Read this." So I did. And he said, "Okay, here's what I want to do. You can be our engineer, and you can also be the announcer on Sundays." and my only requirement on being the engineer is I don't care what hours you keep for that or anything else. That just the station has to stay on the air.
Oh, buddy. Well, and I got to tell you, I loved when you sent me back your reply. You said, "Yeah, I was the chief engineer," and then in parentheses, "the only engineer." But
that's right.
Yeah, but you were the boss. You were the boss,
and only one person the boss.
Were you good at it?
Well, the station stayed on the air.
We're still on. You must have did a good job. We're still on the air.
Yeah, I carried a little transistor radio around me with me all the time, tuned to KSI, so I'd be sure to catch it if it went off.
Oh, my. I'll tell you, sometimes it's painful, isn't it, my friend? I will tell you that being vigilant is sometimes the most difficult job. But anyway, you've had an illustrious career, and your major was in engineering, right?
Well, I started in engineering, but I ended up graduating in what they call general science.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, because I switched around a bit, and general science was a degree where you didn't have any majors, you had minors.
Okay.
And so I was able to use some things I had, math, physics, and naval science, and television production, and journalism, and tie them together and said, okay, that's good for a degree.
Well, you know what? There's something to be said about that, though, because you were so diversified, to be honest.
I don't regret the experience at all. I think it was all very helpful.
Yeah, and you have held several positions, and I thought it was interesting as I was going through your biography. A lot to do in Chicago, though, with education.
Well, that was interesting. We moved back to Chicago from New York, where we'd been with General Electric, and decided we wanted to get involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things that came up was a school board election.
Mm-hmm.
And some folks said, "Well, okay, why don't you run for the school board?" And I did, for the high school board. I didn't even know where the high school was. 'Cause my kids were in like second grade or something.
Yeah.
And I won.
Huh.
And a year later, they elected me president of the board. So that was a really great experience.
Mm-hmm. And then you ended up on the National Board of Directors of Literacy Volunteers of America. That's quite a title. Did you have a business card big enough for that?
LVA is, they've merged with somebody else now, and so that title doesn't exist anymore. But that, you know, I got really interested in literacy as a cause, and managed to get hooked up with them. They were headquartered in Syracuse or Rochester, New York. And so I served on the board for a couple of years with them.
Mm-hmm. And then you you were teaching also, I say, Vila University, William Jewell College, and University of Missouri at Kansas City. And what were you teaching in those?
Marketing.
Ah.
Marketing at UMKC.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an MBA at Avila. It was an MBA course in entrepreneurship.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, you know something about that. You founded and had your own company, a consulting firm, Telcon Associates, for 30 years. You seem to be a man of your time.
Well, thank you. I take that as a compliment.
I mean it indeed as a compliment. We know the difference between 1959 and now, and how technology has advanced, and being an entrepreneur and taking that first step into your own business and works is a brave step to take, but obviously successful for you. 30 years there until you retired. Does Telcon Associates still exist then, still working away?
Telcon does still exist. It was a great and often very, very stressful experience.
I'm sure.
Especially not only when you're getting started and making lots of mistakes, but then later on when you're still making lots of mistakes and managed to see them just soon enough so they don't sink you. But but Telcon is still going strong. And you talk about time passing and technology. I didn't have to be out of it, and we were a telecommunications consultant. Now, I didn't have to be out of it for more than a couple of 3 years until I realized I didn't really know anything about current telecommunications anymore.
It does move fast, doesn't it? Just in the years that I've been in it over the years, I know. And then you retire from business, and you and your lovely wife, Carol, are now living down in Braunfels, Texas. Are you still there?
We moved down to New Braunfels. Now it's almost 10 years ago. Our daughter lives in Austin.
Okay.
And we're only about an hour away from her. So we decided that we'd like to live a little bit closer to her because she had been living there for 20 years or so, and we hadn't seen much of her. So we came down here. We had been traveling down, of course, and looked around and said, I think this would be a good place.
And you start a website, History Speaks Today. What inspired you to do that?
It was starting before I retired and moved down here, but it grew out of a growing frustration for an observation that people, particularly our leaders in America and our politicians, didn't seem to learn anything from history.
Wow.
And we kept doing, in my view, the same wrong things that had proven out to be wrong in the past.
Okay.
So I got, and just thinking about it sort of, and I said, well, maybe part of the reason is they never learned the lessons of history is because history doesn't teach lessons for today, at least not directly, at least not the way the history I took was taught, because when I was going to school, and maybe you remember it too, in history classes usually were a case of studying a particular time or period or country and memorizing the names and the dates. And if you could remember all of that stuff, then you got a good grade on a test.
Mm-hmm.
So they talked about the who, what, when, where, maybe why of history. But what was missing, I came to decide, was the so what. Mm-hmm. So why are we studying this? What does it do for us? And I decided to see if I could, you know, more crystallize the so what of history by bringing historical lessons down to today in terms that made them more practical, applicable, and crystallized.
And it seems to me, Bruce, and part of that is your interest in politics had to be instrumental in the way that you were perceiving this history, et cetera, or applying it. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement because kind of my first foray in politics, I guess, was I ran in my junior year. I ran for student body president at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm.
Did not win.
What?
but there were lessons.
Mm-hmm.
getting involved in politics in Chicago, in the Chicago area, in Cook County, was a huge education.
Mm-hmm.
It was an eye-opener about the way things worked, at least there, and probably a lot of other places. And there was a lot of disillusionment to it after a while. I had thought that I wanted to go into politics as a career, and after a while I said, nope, that's not for me.
Were you too honest? Bruce?
I'm sorry?
Were you too honest?
Well, that's a way of putting it. I literally, Carol and I talked about it, and the decision was I didn't see any way to make a big career in politics without compromising principles.
Okay. That's,
and I didn't want to do that.
You and I are eye to eye on that. I almost swore-ed myself into it and decided I believe in compromise, but there's just plain wrong sometimes, and I couldn't bring myself along certain party lines to do that. So, but anyway, enough about me. I'll tell you what, can you hang on with me? We're going to go through a break here, and then I want to get to the meat of the issues, your book.
Okay.
Out there, and Rise and Decline, where we are and what we can do about it. That coming
okay.
up next.
I'll be here.
All right, Bruce, thank you. Bruce Thatcher is my guest. He is an author of three different books. We're going to talk about one of them. I would not be surprised that we might slip off into other areas there, but I'm excited about this. Iowa State graduate. You know he's smart. You know he's smart. Bruce Thatcher, coming back after this news break. And welcome back. Mel of the Morning on 1430 KESI. My guest, Bruce Thatcher. Author of three books out there. We're going to be talking about one of them today, but three hearty in endeavor. And what made you get into the writing aspect? Oh, again, there we go.
I was trying to figure out a way to make historical lessons more precise and more meaningful to today's environment. So I suppose the first one was just kind of I wonder if this will work approach. I adopted a case approach and said, well, let's make each book cover just one lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look for historical cases that demonstrate that lesson and put them together in a format that lets people either read it in great detail or get the lessons in kind of summary form if they choose. And so that first book was called Adam and Aggressors, and I sort of hypothesized and then changed and demonstrated that the lessons are that if you're going to deal with an Adam and Aggressor, who is somebody who doesn't absolutely will not change what they're going to do, they're obsessed with their goal, then you first better realize what your own national interests are and what the aggressors are and whether or not there's a conflict. Because if there is, you only have two choices. You either give up your interests or you make sure the adamant aggressor cannot realize his. Right. And then there's some lessons that go along with it, like deal from strength and remember that all negotiations are temporary. They never solve the situation. So I went and then looked for obvious cases, or some maybe not so obvious. Remember the conqueror in the 1500s, conquered Constantinople, and one of our presidents, our 11th president, James K. Polk, was an adamant aggressor. At least if you were in Mexico, you thought he was. And Hitler and Stalin, of course, and then Chaim Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion, as they went about forming Israel. And the lessons that were learned from that then led to this synopsis for the book. Did the same thing with immigration, immigration policies, and studied 11 policies of 7 different nations, including obviously our own, and then finally took another shot at this idea of rise and decline of nations. Where are we?
What we can do about it. I'm kind of interested. I'll go back to adamant aggressors, but as you perceive this and have written a book about this, then as recent as today's headlines, the North Korea and United States situation, that title that you're talking about and how you describe it could easily apply to what we're experiencing in that situation, can't it?
Well, it sure does. The whole Kim Jong-un and his father and grandfather all were adamant aggressors. Their targets were South Korea, and now I think that's probably still Kim Jong-un's target. I'm positive that they're obsessed. There is no way they will forego or give up their objectives. And we have dealt with them since the 50s. You know, way back, starting with the Korean War, when we met force with force, but we didn't settle the situation. And since then, we have, and particularly with Kim Jong-un in power, we have negotiated, in my mind, with a mistaken idea of what we could accomplish. We have failed to do the things that would have stopped him back when it would have been less catastrophic, and we're now, because time is always of the essence, we're now down to not very many options.
When I say you're as recent as the day's headlines, so then your next book, Immigration, is so timely too, because obviously that has been a big subject of this presidency.
There are three principles that you find guiding the every successful immigration policy I studied. And I studied 11 different immigration policies of 7 different countries. 3 of those policies were American immigration policies. Our third one started in 1965. First two were successful because they had clearly defined national interests that immigration was to support. They had clear laws to support those policies and those principles, and they had programs, or they had in effect effective assimilation of immigrants. And those are the three principles. We violate all of them now with our current policy. It's just a shambles.
Boy. Well, let's get to Rise and Decline, your latest book out there. And this one might scare some people, especially as I go into our first question here, because I've heard this over years. I even heard this, believe it or not, from my history teacher back in high school. Very brilliant man, I always thought, and he was saying that America, much like the Roman Empire, et cetera, will enjoy its degree of stability, but at some point will begin to lose the respect, et cetera, or the necessities to maintain its empireship. And that kind of sounds where you're going as you're back in history. You say America may cease to exist, right?
Well, I think it's inevitable.
Okay.
You can't absolutely say that, because we haven't ceased to exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
of the several thousand nations that have ever existed in the world, there's only a couple hundred of them still left. And none of them, except for those couple of hundred, none of them have survived. So you look at often the Roman Empire, or in my case, what I do is the Roman Republic, serve as an analog of the United States in terms of rise and decline. And that comparison is often made. I think that the odds are just virtually certain that we will cease to exist. So one of the questions is, well, how do you react to that? Do you just say, well, that's the way it is, and let's not worry about it? Or are there some things you can do to mitigate and prolong the nature of our life in America as it exists? There probably are. Whether we'll do it or not, I don't know.
Yeah, and when we look at that, when we say ceases to exist as we know it, or as the country altogether?
Well, the nation will cease to exist.
Okay.
Nations are, I define a nation as a political entity with boundaries and recognized by other nations in the world as something distinct. The nation may, in name, continue to exist as France has for hundreds and hundreds of years, even though it's had maybe 10 or a dozen different government structures, ranging all the way from monarchy to a republic. That is the sort of thing I would expect with the United States, unless you're conquered and taken over by another nation, and I don't expect that to happen, at least not in any foreseeable way. Unless that happens, then probably the United States in name continues to exist, but it's not the republic or the democracy that we know.
Okay. So let's bring it up to today again. New president, different type of president than this country has ever had before. His goal, obviously, it's all over the hats and banners, make America great again. Is that possible, or is that lip service?
Well, depends on what he, or more important, what the people who hear him say that understand by that term great. But whatever they understand by it, great doesn't mean necessarily great always and forever. My suspicion is that if we are successful at this time in recovering momentum or whatever's involved in becoming, put in quotes, great, that we will rise and enjoy another period of greater prominence in the world, but that will not change the downward trend of our world prominence.
Does the nation ever fall into, let's use our nation as an example again, second class nation instead of a first class nation? Do you lose respect?
I would suppose that yes, you do fall into your prominence is eclipsed by another nation who takes it over and in the world and then you become a, I hate to say second class, but you become a less prominent, less significant nation in the course of events of the world. We certainly see that with the United Kingdom, which is one of my cases. The United Kingdom is a nation that still exists, but it's been on the decline for 80 years or so, 80 or 90 years. Its empire has shrunk to maybe 3 or 4% of what it was at its peak. Its power and prominence in the world in almost all things has declined, and it's in danger of becoming a different country if Scotland, if and when Scotland finally decides to break away, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It was a part, or is a part, of the European Union, and some 17,000 laws and regulations in the United Kingdom now are laws and regulations that were enacted by the European Union and weren't even enacted and approved by the people of Great Britain or United Kingdom. So it's a much less significant nation than it once was.
And Bruce, have we reached the peak and have already begun the decline of this country?
I suppose you could get quite a discussion on that from various people. I think the answer to that question is yes. And a lot of writers have said that question is yes. I have seen books and articles and papers and so forth that say, that argue that we reached the peak in the 1960s, and from there on it's been downhill. Others might say, well, the world, 9/11,
mm-hmm.
2001 was the time when we started our decline. I have suggested in my book that the decline started a bit earlier than that, in 1993, with the first bombing of the World Trade Center, because that demonstrated that we could no longer prevent attacks in our own land. And that's the first time since the War of 1812 that was the case.
And I have to say I concur with you on that. My thoughts were along the same way. I happened to be working on papers at that time discussing terrorism. And I have to say that was my conclusion. That's when I felt that we began to feel vulnerability and changed our lives significantly. According to that, I'm glad to hear someone else say that. Sometimes I need someone. You know what I'm saying?
I sure do. Every time I read something that agrees with me, I think the writer is brilliant.
Well, Bruce Thatcher, you're brilliant. I can tell you that right now. I'm going along with that. By the way, this is Bruce Thatcher. We're talking about his latest book, Rise and Decline: Where We Are and What We Can Do About It. Well, What's the signs we're seeing here in America, then, that the decline is on?
I think the signs that we're in decline get back to the founding values, and in particular the rights and liberties that are associated in that. So if you read the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, which clearly defines liberty as a founding principle of this country, and then read the Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights, to the first 10 amendments of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
that tells what our values were when we're founded. And now, I see all around us, through my lens at least, where not only are governments infringing on those values, and they always have,
mm-hmm.
but great masses of our people don't seem to care about a lot of those rights anymore, at least not for anybody but themselves.
Yeah, but
and those are all bad signs.
Have we become a selfish nation? I mean, what I'm hearing here is in some ways, I don't think it's true in all ways, but it's about me, my welfare, and those who surround my life welfare rather than the overall picture.
Yeah, and it's about me and the rights I want for me. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think other people ought to have. As a matter of fact, I think other people who disagree with me ought not to have the rights I have.
Yeah. It sounds, it's kind of, well, no, it's not kind of, it's kind of depressing. You know, it sounds pretty down, I guess, is what I want to say. But is it beyond repair? I guess that's the big question. If we know it's headed on the downslide, are there ways we can repair it, preserve it, or is it just totally inevitable?
I think there are. Well, the answer is yes and yes. I think that if we look at the current situation, there are ways that we can repair it, but they're not easy.
Mm-hmm.
They're not easy solutions, and they're long-term. And there's the problem, because we have a hard time focusing on anything other than next week or next month,
mm-hmm.
let alone next generation in this country. So the question isn't, can we repair it as much as it is, will we?
Is that a hard sale?
Yeah.
I know the answer, but I had to have you do it again so we can feel
it. It's a hard sell, because people are short-term by nature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the Gresham's law of planning. Short-term always drives out long-term.
I think even despite some of the situations for some people here, we still think we've got it pretty darn good here. That, I'm still feeding. I still got the roof over the head. I've got three cars. I only need two. Actually, don't even need two, but the whole thing is that maybe because we have it too good, this is one of the reasons we are on the short-term track.
I think there's a relationship with that, mm-hmm. by all means. We have it very good in this country. I can't imagine anywhere else where I would rather live.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of all of the problems and all of the things you can see wrong, our life in the United States of America is really pretty great. It just may not be quite as great by some small margin as it was, say, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening is incremental, and it will be any decline will be barely noticed from generation to generation.
Do you think though that we're seeing a bigger division now economically? The rich get richer, and the average person stays average. Would that have any bearing?
Well, I tell you, some writers hold that up as a huge indicator,
mm-hmm.
of decline, the growing divide between rich and poor. I haven't focused on that specifically, and I'm still sort of thinking about it. I think it's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that its causes are not as clear as some writers would argue. But I think it is a problem, and it is a sign, one of the concomitants of decline.
Yeah. Well, Bruce, I'm running out of time. Unfortunately, we've just gotten to the tip. Number one, I'm going to ask you this question. At some point here, can I call on you again? You are such an interesting person, and you got such a great perspective out here. Love to have you back on the program again.
Sure, I'd be delighted.
And secondly, I want everybody to go out there, not just get this book that you have out now, Rise and Decline, Where We Are and What We Can Do About It. I think it would be instrumental, and the subjects you've chosen are certainly amongst the most interesting and very timely as they relate to today. Where are your books available, and how can people get them?
Well, they're all available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, for instance, and a lot of other places. Probably the easiest way to find them is to go on my website, historyspeakstoday.com, because it gives you links to mm-hmm. all the places where they're available.
Now, along those lines, you've got three out there. What's your next?
I haven't decided yet.
Would you like us to send in suggestions, or...?
I'm delighted to hear suggestions. As a matter of fact, the website even has a provision for providing suggestions.
Well, it sounds like you're just absolutely enjoying what you're doing here. Does it ever worry you? I mean, the subjects you've approached here are certainly on top of a lot of our minds out there. Is it sometimes a little eye opening even for thee?
It's always eye opening,
mm-hmm.
but. I'm probably an example of a lot of people in America and their point of view to it. At my age, I don't believe any of it will significantly affect me.
I know what you're talking about now. You're just a few years older than I am. And, I've recently come to that, too. But as you have and as I have, we get those generations behind us there that we want to enjoy life as much as we do.
But I am concerned about children and grandchildren and family.
Right.
Rise and Decline is dedicated to our great grandchildren and by name in there, and that or our grandchildren rather, and that kind of shows what I would hope could happen.
Well, Bruce, I'll tell you what, I'm glad you retired, but I'm glad you didn't retire from your thoughts and your writings. We look forward to much more. And I will talk with you down the road, my friend. I deeply appreciate it. Thank you.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Mel.
Thanks, Bruce. Bye-bye. Bruce Thatcher was my guest today. And what an interesting person, and the subjects, tough to do.